Good afternoon. It's wonderful to see a packed house, I just have to tell you. It's wonderful. I'm Nicole Austin Hillary, and I'm the director and counsel of the Washington, D.C. office of the Brennan Center for Justice. Welcome to this afternoon's discussion with Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, from the great state of Delaware, who is going to talk to us this afternoon about our democracy. And where we are in terms of voting and how we move forward. I don't know about you, but I'm excited to hear this discussion. It is timely, it is of the moment, and I think we're all ready to be energized by this discussion. The Brennan Center for Justice is a national think tank and legal advocacy organization. We like to use several different mechanisms to do what we like to call reform and protect our systems of justice and democracy. We use litigation, advocacy, research, and strategic communications to do just that. And we are particularly focused on and proud of doing what we like to call protecting equal justice and serving our democracy. So what better thing to do than to gather this afternoon and have a discussion about one of the core parts of our democracy, and that's the right to vote. And what better person to do it than Senator Coons, who since his beginning in the U.S. Senate has been a champion of voting rights. And I'd like to tell you just on a personal note that I had the pleasure in 2013 of joining Senator Coons on Congressman John Lewis's annual pilgrimage to Selma, which is something he does every year, and it's a bipartisan pilgrimage with members from the House and Senate who are from both sides of the aisle who come together to commemorate that momentous and historic march and come together to basically talk about and represent why voting rights is so important in the United States. Senator Chris Coons has passionately fought for these ideas, and we are glad that he is here today to share that passion with us. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Senator Coons.
Well, thank you, Nicole. Thank you for that gracious introduction, for our friendship, for the sponsorship of the Brennan Center, for the elegant lunch everyone got to enjoy here at the Press Club, and for a chance to be with a wide-ranging group of friends who are concerned about our republic, about voting rights, and about our path forward. Over the past several months, we've heard a lot about the Russian government and its interference in our last presidential election, and rightly so. I think we have to treat Russian aggression as a fundamental threat to our democracy, a threat that it truly is. But we've heard a lot less about something else that's just as destructive and sadly just as effective at undermining the integrity of our democracy, a decades-long assault on American voting rights. This campaign is nothing less than a sustained attack on American democracy from within. The right to vote is a core element of our democracy, yet we still struggle to secure that right for all Americans. As Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, quote, "So long as I do not firmly and irrevocably possess the right to vote, I do not possess myself. I cannot live as a democratic citizen, observing the laws I have helped to enact. I can only submit to the edict of others." Civil rights crusaders of the past knocked down many legal barriers to the ballot box. Now we have to confront the challenges posed by a quieter, but no less harmful, no less vicious campaign to reduce access. Modern tactics are hidden behind seemingly benign objectives, objectives such as fighting voter fraud and protecting election integrity. Who could disagree with those objectives? So today I'll discuss these tactics and what we can and must do to confront them. I'll review how our courts have a critical role to play in both creating and correcting the status quo in which too many Americans are today prevented from exercising their fundamental right to vote. I'll also touch on why we can't rely on the courts, the Department of Justice, or even Congress alone to step in and address this situation, and why the American people have to step up if we're going to ensure our democracy. Well, first, we have to start with the Supreme Court's 2013 decision in Shelby County versus Holder. In Shelby County, the Supreme Court did something that just a short time before would have been unthinkable. It struck down a vital provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the landmark law that was one of the greatest achievements of the modern civil rights movement in America. Before Shelby County, as I suspect many of you know, the U.S. Department of Justice had the power to review changes in voting laws to ensure these changes were not being enacted with discriminatory intent or effect. This review, known as preclearance, was not required nationwide. Instead, it was applied to states and localities with a demonstrated history of racial discrimination. In the years following the Voting Rights initial enactment in 1965, the law was reauthorized repeatedly and with broad bipartisan support. In fact, as recently as 2006, Congress overwhelmingly reauthorized the Voting Rights Act after considering thousands of pages of evidence to show that it was both necessary and effective. Yet by 2013, neither overwhelming evidence nor broad bipartisan support mattered to five justices of the Supreme Court. In Shelby County, the majority invalidated the Section 4 formula, a critical piece of the Voting Rights Act, and thus disarmed the preclearance provision that required federal approval of new voting laws before they could go into effect. Since then, new voter suppression efforts have multiplied, undermining voter participation in local, state, and national elections across our country. To understand the context that led to this Shelby County decision, we have to go back to 2008, just a few years before, 5 years before, when the case first began making its way through the federal courts. That year, in the national election of 2008, African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans turned out to vote in historic, in record numbers. 4 years later, for the first time in American history, the rate of black voter turnout exceeded that of white voters. Some of my colleagues and I saw this as a victory for the Voting Rights Act, proof that it was having its necessary effect. But others saw it as evidence that preclearance was no longer needed. Using that logic to upend the preclearance formula, the Supreme Court opened the floodgates to dozens of new voting restrictions. The Shelby County dissent captured the backwards logic of thinking that we no longer needed the Voting Rights Act precisely because the law was working relatively well. As Justice Ginsburg observed in that dissent, the majority's reasoning was, quote, like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. The impact of Shelby County was immediate and, I would say, devastating. The North Carolina experience captures it, summarizes it in a nutshell. At the time of Shelby County, the North Carolina State Legislature had been considering a new bill to restrict voting access. Because the Voting Rights Act's preclearance provision no longer restrained them, state legislators said that they could abandon their narrower objectives and go with what they described as the full bill. The new North Carolina law enacted voter ID requirements, scrapped same-day registration, and slashed early voting. After 2 years of litigation that followed, the Fourth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals made the damning finding that such reforms were not only discriminatory in effect, but had been passed with racially discriminatory intent. North Carolina, sadly, wasn't alone. State legislatures from North Carolina to North Dakota to Texas to Kansas to Wisconsin also went with the full bill. Courts across the country have been able to bat down some of these restrictions, but the courts have far more limited tools since Shelby County changed the scope and reach and power of the Voting Rights Act. Five states have already approved new voting restrictions this year alone. How did this happen? I'll point to two causes. First, there's no doubt that Shelby County empowered those with an intent to discriminate. In the words of the Fourth Circuit's decision striking down North Carolina's law, legislators have targeted racial minorities' access to the ballot box with, quote, surgical precision. Today, many of these discriminatory restrictions are hidden behind baseless claims of preventing voter fraud and protecting election integrity. In reality, these tactics are nothing more than an excuse to suppress the vote and particularly the vote of communities of color. The second problem that led to the post-Shelby County era is that those of us who oppose these voter suppression efforts have failed to raise awareness about the actual impact of these laws. Too many Americans, especially white Americans, haven't experienced generations of government-sanctioned discrimination and as a result are dismissive or simply unaware of the actual impact of these laws. They don't realize that 10% of all Americans don't have the right form of identification within newly enacted voter ID laws. They may not appreciate how difficult it is to take time off of work to vote on election day or to get a driver's license or another acceptable form of voter ID. Or they don't notice or are willfully blind to DMVs and early voting places being closed only in certain places or on certain days or in certain neighborhoods. Moreover, they don't see these laws keep Americans from voting and disproportionately impact people of color. They don't understand why discriminatory voting laws wouldn't just be struck down by the courts. As I've talked with folks across this country at times, I hear they don't realize that after Shelby County, even the most egregious discriminatory laws often aren't blocked until after an election, when the electoral damage has already been done. Too many Americans don't realize that voter suppression works and that it has a cumulative and destructive effect on our democracy that builds with every election. So what does this mean for real people, for real voters? If you're a Florida resident who wasn't allowed to vote in 2000 because you lived in a predominantly African-American community and were eliminated from the voter rolls because your name was too similar to the name of a felon, you're not going to think that the democratic process includes you. If you're an Ohioan who in 2004 took hours off of work to wait in line due to reduced polling hours, but had to leave before getting the chance to vote, you're not going to believe that our democracy wants you to vote. If you're a Texas student who is turned away from voting, even though you brought a state-issued university ID as proof of identification, you're not going to believe in our democratic process. If you're an African-American churchgoer in North Carolina who used to vote on the Sunday before Election Day, election after election, before Sunday voting was eliminated in counties across that state, you will understandably feel shut out of our democracy. If you're a Wisconsin voter in 2016 who brought three forms of ID to vote, but was still turned away from the polls because you didn't have a driver's license, can anyone blame you for thinking the democratic process has been rigged to exclude you? These real examples happen over and over again in state after state, in election after election. Over time, voter suppression makes elected officials less accountable to people who we represent by reducing voter turnout, voter trust, and voter engagement. It increases Americans' apathy towards the democratic process while decreasing their trust in the process and its results. And it harms our credibility in the world by leading other nations to question the legitimacy of our elections and the sincerity with which we assert the centrality of democracy to our nation. Through all of this, voter suppression has a corrosive impact on the strength and integrity of our democracy. One of the most challenging aspects of the fight for voting rights is the sense of hopelessness, apathy, and cynicism that these laws create. For those of you who are here today because you want to fight this problem, here's what you can do. First, and I know this will surprise you, volunteer to help great organizations like the Brennan Center. That deserves a round of applause. Support critical organizations which are continuing to fight these battles in our courts. It's true that Shelby County deprived us of an important tool, but we have to continue to use the portions of the Voting Rights Act that remain to defend access to the ballot box. And that requires difficult, complex, and persistent litigation. This fight will, to be blunt, be even harder without the cooperation and support of the Justice Department. Since Attorney General Sessions was sworn in, we've already seen the Federal Department of Justice drop one claim of intentional discrimination in Texas. But the Brennan Center and other groups kept fighting. And last month, the district court ruled again that Texas legislators enacted restrictions with an intent to discriminate against minority voters. These and other victories are why we have to keep up the fight in the courts and refuse to give in to cynicism or apathy. But we can't stop there. The second important thing we have to do is to consistently and decisively debunk baseless claims by the Trump administration and many others of widespread voter fraud. The president's so-called Commission on Election Integrity, I will remind you, is not going to investigate Russian interference in our election. It's instead going to be, frankly, a waste of time and taxpayer dollars because it will be a futile attempt to justify the president's groundless claims that millions of people voted illegally. And I'm concerned it will be nothing more than a pretext for further actions aimed at voter suppression. So we need to shine some light on what this commission will actually do and to challenge the factual basis of what its leaders may well say. This brings me to the third field in which we have to compete, the legislative process. The most important step Congress could take is to restore or modernize the preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act. Shelby County put Congress on notice. We needed to act, and I got to work with a number of colleagues on revised legislation. The Senate Judiciary Committee convened a hearing just weeks after the Shelby County decision on the necessary updates to the Voting Rights Act to address its action. In 2015, I joined a group of more than 40 senators and 100 members of the House to introduce the Voting Rights Advancement Act. Among its many provisions, this critical bill would have created a new geographic coverage formula, allowing federal courts to bail in states for preclearance and ensuring voters had to be made aware of any last-minute changes to state voting procedures. Most importantly, it would have allowed the court at the start of voting rights litigation to halt a challenged practice rather than waiting until after the election when it's too late to vindicate voters' rights. These critical provisions would have gone a long way towards healing the damage done by the Shelby County decision, but the bill never made it out of committee in the last Congress. In fact, despite tireless efforts to secure bipartisan support, which literally included my carrying a copy of the bill and haranguing Republican colleagues as we marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge at the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act inspiring march, only one Republican senator joined this bill, Senator Murkowski of Alaska. The Republican Party, of which my family was proudly a member for decades, was previously a champion of civil rights and, in particular, voting rights. It is deeply disappointing to me and many others that advocacy for voting rights has now evolved from being broadly bipartisan to nearly unanimously a party line concern. That's why I encourage you to call your member of Congress, maybe particularly your Republican member of Congress, to ask why they don't support this bill. It is a responsible action in response to a Supreme Court decision that the formula in the Voting Rights Act, despite congressional evidence and action otherwise, needed to be updated. It's been updated. Why would Republican members of Congress not support this balanced bill? Ask your Republican members of Congress why they don't think voting rights matter in this modern era. Because frankly, every election that passes without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act represents a critical, cumulative, lost opportunity for justice. But we can't focus just on restoring the Voting Rights Act, central though it is. We have to seek other proactive measures to increase voter engagement, like the Fast Voting Act, a bill I introduced last year and will reintroduce in this Congress. The Fast Voting Act would create a new program to help participating states develop comprehensive plans to improve their election processes. That means making registration more flexible, providing for early and absentee voting, helping voters with disabilities and language barriers, and better training election officials, all of which strike me as common sense improvements to ballot access. The Fast Voting Act would also make an immediate measurable impact on restoring integrity to our democratic process. So if there is a commission seeking to improve voter and electoral integrity, I recommend this bill to them. But I'm frankly under no illusions that Congress will likely take action on this bill either, particularly since it has yet to secure any Republican support. That's why members of Congress have to use the platforms we've been given, with the support of organizations like the Brennan Center and other advocates for social justice. We have to continue to raise awareness of this and other issues. We have to rebut the claims of President Trump and others to rampant voter fraud, despite public testimony to the contrary, by local elected officials, Republicans and Democrats, who are charged with the integrity of elections at the county and state level. We have to use congressional oversight authority to keep a close eye on the Department of Justice and to make sure that this administration follows the letter of the law and the spirit of our Constitution. We have to fight state by state and county by county to ensure legislatures and governors restore the voting rights of many who have been disenfranchised, including particularly those with felony convictions who've served their time and paid their debt to society. We have to share the stories, the real stories of voters in states across the country to show just how pervasive discrimination and disenfranchisement remain today. And frankly, we have to get involved in the mechanics of government at the most local level, because it is in city and county office buildings, not the halls of Congress, where voting hours are determined, polling places are set, and district lines redrawn. Most importantly, we have to pursue each of these steps before another election happens with discriminatory barriers in place. Together, these efforts will help the American people better understand that for far too many of our fellow citizens, voting is still a privilege, not a right. I began my remarks today referencing a dire threat facing American democracy: the interference of a foreign adversary that sought to sway and may have impacted the outcome of our last presidential election. And we need to confront this threat with real and great urgency. But we also have to confront a threat to our democracy that has nothing to do with Vladimir Putin, has nothing to do with an expansive and aggressive Russia: the systemic undermining of Americans' right to vote. As we face this challenge, we have to remember that voting alone is not enough. Activism every 4 years is not enough. Democracy requires you, a citizenry that's consistently active, attentive, and engaged in state and local government as much as here in Washington and on the national stage. In the words of Justice Ginsburg's Shelby County dissent, "The arc of the moral universe is indeed long, but it bends towards justice if there is a steadfast commitment to see the task through to completion. It is up to us to make and maintain that commitment." Thank you for the chance to be with you today. Nicole, I look forward to our conversation. Thank you for the support of the Brennan Center.
Thank you so much, Senator Coons. And I'm going to give you all a chance to talk too. I see some friends in the audience and they know I like to talk, but I promise I won't take up all the time. Senator Coons, one of the first questions I have for you is this. Clearly, this room is full of a lot of enlightened people who are engaged in our democracy, who work on issues like voting day in and day out. But it's the people that our organizations work with, that we represent, the people back in the states. I have to tell you, I have people ask me all the time, given all that's going on in our country right now, why does voting still matter? And I think we have to be able to tell them why it is the crux of our democracy. What advice do you have for what we should be telling people, grassroots folks, folks on the ground, folks who are concerned about jobs and housing and education, when they say, help me to understand how voting fits into that larger paradigm?
This is a hard conversation. It's a hard conversation to have well, and it's a hard conversation in which to move people. If you're frustrated or upset, if you feel that your local government isn't responding to you, if you feel like there's somebody, whether it's in the White House or the governor's mansion or the mayor's office or city hall, who just doesn't care about you, you have to have a voice. To have a voice, you have to vote. To vote, you have to have rules around voting that allow you to vote. Mm-hmm. Not an ideal citizen who happens to have perfect ID, who happens to have a job that lets them off on just the right hours and just the right places. And the challenge is helping Americans who feel disenfranchised, who are disenfranchised, know that their vote will change things. As I said in my remarks, exactly the impact cumulatively, cycle after cycle, of voter disenfranchisement is it leads to voter apathy. which then accomplishes what I think was the original pernicious goal, which was to drive out of the ballot box exactly those who might change the status quo.
And let's talk about that a little bit, about driving certain people out of the ballot box. I'm going to bring it up, everybody, the issue of race. Mm-hmm. And you talked about it in your comments. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court just recently, in its redistricting decision from earlier this week, talked about how, race was clearly evident in terms of one of the intentions with respect to the redrawing of those lines in the Cooper decision. You know, how do we reconcile race and what it means and the fact that it is the underpinning of so many of the laws that were created in this country, and the fact that courts are still saying now, in Texas, for instance, that racial intent seems to be at the heart of some of these rules that legislatures across the country are trying to put in place. How do we deal with that?
This is the piece of working on voting rights and voting access that is hardest for me to keep a civil tongue in my head while talking to colleagues. Because we can have a debate or a discussion about how decades and decades after the civil rights movement, this should be a colorblind country. And I've had Republican colleagues tell me that we don't need the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, we've come a long way and we've made huge progress and this is a different country. And the election of certain officials proves that this isn't. And the Supreme Court and circuit courts and district courts in now case after case and state after state have said, no, that's not the case. There continue to be lines drawn that are intentionally drawn in response to a racially discriminatory intent. So I find it hard to believe that there are people of goodwill who can look at that evidence and not believe they have an obligation to act. I understand why some want to believe that we're in a post-racial society, but all the evidence is to the contrary. And the concentration and the correlation in the criminal justice setting, education, economic opportunity, and access to the ballot box is so clearly determined on racial lines that you have to be willfully blind to not see this.
Now, Senator Coons, you spent a lot of time in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. You and I were just talking earlier today about your trip to South Africa. Yeah. How does the rest of the world see us when they hear when they hear talk about voting, when they hear about Russian hacking, when they hear that there are laws that are being passed by state legislatures that make it harder for some Americans to vote? What do they think about that? Because we are supposed to be the world's premier democracy. We're supposed to set examples. How's the rest of the world reacting to all of this? And what do you say to them as one of our national leaders?
Well, I remember very soon, very early after the inauguration, I went to a security conference in Halifax with Senator McCain, a number of other Republican senators, and we were bombarded with elected leaders and national leaders from dozens of countries across Eastern Europe, Western Europe, Southeast Asia, South Asia, from around the world, who were alarmed and concerned about President Trump's rhetoric during the campaign, about the allegations of interference, and about some of the challenges we face. I'll never forget one individual from Poland saying to me, if you won't defend your democracy, how can we count on you to defend our democracy? And there are places in the world where there are significant challenges, threats to the functioning of democracies, or where they've never really fully functioned at all, where the courts aren't independent, where civil society and a free press really isn't vibrant, and where elections happen, but they're not really free and fair and effective elections. And historically, the American ambassador or American delegations or representatives of the American administration, the NDI or IRI, would come and speak and say, you know, you need to improve. Now, I think we are compelled to be more humble in describing our democracy given these dynamics. And to be blunt, there is a war of ideas in the developing world in particular. I spent a lot of time in Africa. I've been to 28 countries in Africa. And the Chinese are in almost every country on the continent. Mm-hmm. And the argument is made by some other countries, Russia and China principally among them. You know, your development, your trajectory of development will be so much smoother and easier without all these annoying multi-party elections and journalists and human rights activists, all that mess and fuss. You need an election, but, you know, you don't need multiple candidates. And you don't need a free press. You don't need an open society. And it can be, you know, right, one and done. And then you can get back to the business of governing. And democracy is a messy fraud in the United States. Having this corrosive campaign in our own country to deny access to the ballot box to tens of millions of Americans puts the lie in their eyes to our assertion that we really believe in democracy, that it's actually what we're fighting for, that it's what we care about, that it's why we send troops overseas, that it's why we invest in development, that it's the point and purpose of our diplomacy. The more the foreign press can appropriately report that our Supreme Court has found that our state legislatures carve up districts, close the doors to polling places, restrict hours with racially discriminatory intent. Imagine how that plays in the rest of the world. We are throwing away moral authority that took us decades and sacrifice to earn. And for what? For temporary partisan advantage in one election over another. It is shocking to me that this is happening in this slow, grinding role without broader response. My father served in Germany in the army. I think he believed he was actually serving to defend democracy. I think virtually everybody who takes on risks like that at home and abroad says and believes that's what they're doing. Yet we're allowing this to happen. And its consequences overseas are almost as bad as they are here at home.
Given all that, you know, so much of the responsibility of this falls at the feet of Congress to lead the way, to be trailblazers. And I have to tell you, Senator Coons, you know, obviously in my work as directing the Brennan Center's Washington office, I spend a lot of time in offices like yours talking to folks on both sides of the aisle. And one of the things that I've heard, particularly from folks who used to be in the Senate, who used to be in Congress, is how the relationships used to be different. And how people could really sit down over coffee, over lunch, and really have one-on-one discussions about some of these issues. How do we get to, and you noted some of the things that we need to do, some of the things that Congress needs to do, but how do we get to that if folks can't sit down and have conversations? If they can't talk about the fact that perhaps you see something differently than they do, but where is a meeting of the minds? I get that question all the time. Nicole, how do you do the work that you do when there is this partisan gridlock?
It is very hard. I will tell you that today I began my day at the weekly prayer breakfast in the Capitol. About 25 senators gathered. We heard from one of our colleagues. There's a very broad range, Democrats, Republicans, Independents. Folks who are, you know, Catholics and Protestants, evangelicals, Mormons, Jews. I mean, a very wide range of religious and political views from across the Senate and the country. And I think your average American would be surprised to know that we actually get to know each other and care for each other and have very personal conversations. But to have that relationship and then not be able to have a functional or effective conversation about the intersection between injustice and blocked access to the ballot box is exceptionally hard. I work with a lot of other members on a lot of issues. It is this issue that has been most destructive of personal relationships I have, because it is hard for me to hear no on this. That's an understatement.
I'm sure. I was hoping you'd give us the answer such that we could solve all the world's problems, Senator. But that's okay.
I think what I almost literally just said is it's going to take prayer. But I will remind you, I began by quoting a pastor.
You did.
It took faith community leadership to change a country's embedded views of each other and to compel change in lots of communities' long set ways. And it is possible. I believe it is possible for justice to be done in this country and for us to move in positive direction. I wouldn't be doing this job if I didn't believe that. But those struggles, that work is long and it is hard and it faces real opposition. This is something that I think deserves that kind of moral force, whether it comes from a place of religious faith or no religious faith, a commitment to the first principles of individual self-determination through the ballot box, through democracy, has to be something that we give moral intensity and energy to.
I have to tell you, I look forward to one day again being invited back to Mr. Lewis's pilgrimage, but when I am, I want it to be that day when every member of the Senate and the House goes on that pilgrimage. Mm. That would be amazing. If we could do that.
We could do that. We could do anything.
That would really be amazing. Let me pivot for a little bit, Senator Coons. You know, there are issues that are inextricably linked to the voting issue. One of them is money in politics. You know, again, the Supreme Court just came out with another recent decision in that area. But sometimes I don't think people necessarily understand why they are so inextricably linked. Sometimes I think when I talk sometimes to people at town hall meetings and things of that nature, they'll say to me, that money is not about me. That's about people who can write big checks. That's about people, you know, who can really, who have a stronger voice than I have. How do we communicate to everyday average voters about why the money in politics issue is important and how in many ways it is just as important as them focusing on how do we get rid of voter suppression, because it too can help to increase their reach and their voice in our democracy?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the answer is embedded in your question, which is, I mean, I disagree respectfully with the Supreme Court's characterization of political contributions as being completely and exactly equivalent to First Amendment-protected political speech. And I think there have to be some reasonable limits on the ability of individuals to write tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in contributions at such a level and with such an impact that it literally bends the trajectory of an election. We all should have a voice, and I think it is possible for a few individuals to have a voice so amplified by their economic means that it drowns out the voices of others. I will point to an encouraging trend from the last presidential election that tens of millions of Americans have chosen to step up and give $3 and $5 and $8. And, you know, I mean, the campaign of Senator Sanders of Vermont was not driven by massive donors. It was driven by very, very small donations from all over the country. And the same is true of other candidates of other types. I don't mean to pick out one, but I really struggle with the idea that we simultaneously have a few billionaires genuinely driving our national politics and an orchestrated, organized campaign at voter suppression where the folks who are driving the politics are also driving the state legislative efforts, funding them.
Sure, sure.
And that begins to me to suggest a really negative broader intent, which is to drown out the voices and participation of those who have a different set of values or priorities in a way that really undermines the very essence of democracy.
You know, the president came out this week with his proposed budget.
Yes, he did.
Yes. And one of the areas that he focused on, and he told us during the campaign that he was going to focus on this, was infrastructure. Yeah. And most of us, when we think of infrastructure, we think of roads and bridges, and those things are obviously very important. But infrastructure also deals with our systems. So when we talk about voting and we talk about making our systems more secure, many of us think, why doesn't this infrastructure discussion include how we improve our election systems? You and I both know, under the Obama administration, he instituted the President's Commission on Election Administration. They came out with a long list of recommendations, many of which had to deal with how do we improve our voting systems, how do we get rid of these old machines, how do we cut down on the long lines. Well, those kinds of things, to me, deal with infrastructure. Is there an opportunity here, as part of the president's budget and as part of his focus on infrastructure, for us to use that as an opening to try to improve our election systems?
You are an optimist, aren't you? I appreciate that. by happy coincidence, the EAC, the electoral, the Election Assistance Commission, falls under my appropriation subcommittee, where I'm the ranking Democrat. The budget does not make any significant new investment in that. Let's just put it that way. Okay. Created in response to some of the striking problems with long election lines, with electoral mechanics several cycles ago, it has really foundered over partisan differences in the commission in terms of where money should be spent, what priorities there should be. The entire American intelligence community, the 17 different agencies that have some intelligence function in the federal government, unanimously reached the conclusion that Russia intentionally interfered in our presidential election based on a decision made at the highest levels of the Russian government. That means one man. And several different hearings by several committees have heard testimony recently that Russia views this as wildly successful, is continuing this behavior in the recent French elections and the upcoming German elections, and we can expect them to do it again. In 2016, there is no evidence that they actually manipulated voting machines to change voter totals or outcomes, but they explored that. We are on notice that the next elections in this country, national or state or municipal, may well be subject to intentional hacking efforts by any of a number of adversaries. Imagine the chaos that would have resulted a week after the presidential election, after one candidate conceded and one declared victory, if there were credible allegations that actual voting machines had been hacked and the numbers changed. We'd still be fighting over that, litigating over that now. And I'm telling you right now, that may very well happen. So to your point about infrastructure, it doesn't matter how you characterize it, whether it's infrastructure or the very core of the machinery of our democracy, to not invest in addressing that threat strikes me as reckless. So I am haranguing colleagues about the importance of our investing in this, because elections are managed and maintained not by the federal government. It is literally the most local government function. Anybody remember the 2000 election? Ever heard of Volusia County, Florida? You probably have. At the next national meeting of county elected officials, of which there are thousands. I remember seeing this table of really earnest-looking people sitting by themselves and no one else talking to them. I walked over and said, "Hi, I'm from Newcastle County, Delaware." They said, "We're from Volusia County, Florida." I said, "Oh, hi." They said, "Yeah." There are thousands of local elected officials at state and county functions all over the country who are really determined to get it right and who work really hard to make sure that the mechanics of voting are run right. Often underfunded, often overlooked. This is often something that nobody runs for who really wants to go into, you know, national politics. It's sort of good souls who are determined to make our democracy work in terms of the people who actually set up the machines and run it. The more pernicious actions I'm talking about typically happen at a state electoral level. But the last time you went into your polling place, did you recognize the people who were sitting there? I did, because they've been sitting there every single election for the last 20 years. It's the same group of people, right? And I've stood for election five times. I've been in the boiler room of a countywide redistricting. I know personally the people who run our state election commission. And we need to invest. We need to make this a higher priority. We need to make certain that there aren't questions about the integrity of our next election. Nothing would produce chaos in our democracy like being unable to trust the actual outcome. 2000 was like flipping a coin and having it land on its side. The presidency of the United States was determined by a few thousand votes in one state. If that happened without interference by a foreign power, imagine what it would feel like if it had happened with interference. And the whole point of my speech today is that interference is happening by malign forces in our own country, and we need to stand up to that.
I'd like to take a moment for those who are listening to us today, Senator Coons, to remind them that this is a program of the New York University Law School's Brennan Center for Justice. You can follow us at the Brennan Center on Facebook and Twitter, and you can listen to all of our programs on iTunes and at brennancenter.org. And again, today we are talking with Senator Christopher Coons, a Democrat from the great state of Delaware. Senator Coons is talking about our voting rights and our democracy, and also the importance of our courts and Congress. And again, I'm Nicole Austin Hillary, the director and counsel of the Washington office of the Brennan Center for Justice. Senator, I have another question for you before we open it up to the audience. And that is this. We've talked, obviously, a lot about voting today. That's why we're here. But there are other parts of our systems of democracy that I think are vitally important right now that we want to make sure people are focused on. Tell us, if you will, what some of those other mechanisms in our democracy are that, given all of the various things that we are dealing with right now, and you illuminated several of them, what are some of the other things we should be looking at? You know, there are efforts underway right now to monitor the practices of the Department of Justice. There are a lot of discussions around the country about our courts, not just our Supreme Court, but about the power of the local courts and how much influence they have and how they can, again, help to change and support and protect our democracy. What are some of those other mechanisms that you think are important for us to keep our eye on right now?
I do want to make sure we get at least one or two questions in for the audience. So let me just briefly say, when you have a national leader who challenges or marginalizes or even threatens or disparages journalism and journalists, federal district court judges and the judiciary, I think we're moving in an unhealthy direction. There's too many places around the world that have constitutions and legal systems that read like ours, look like ours, but do not at all function like ours, where the judiciary is not in fact independent, where the press is not in fact free, and where threats by the head of state or the head of government are not casual. They have actually life-changing or life-ending consequences. And in too many places around the world, our moral authority is undermined when our president makes suggestions like that. And I think we are beginning to socialize the idea of elected leaders who say things that previously would have been unthinkable. So I think the reach and breadth of the negative impact of having casually spoken attacks at the credibility of journalism and journalists, at the credibility and independence of federal judges, is something we genuinely need to pay attention to.
Great. With that, I'm going to open it up to the rest of you to ask questions. So I know some of my colleagues from the Brennan Center, my colleague Jessica is walking around with a microphone, and I will try to be fair as I see hands go up to make sure we get in as many questions as possible. So yes, and would you please tell us who you are and what your affiliation is?
I'm Carl Lubsdorf. I'm a columnist for the Dallas Morning News, former bureau chief. Senator Coons, you've given a rather complete description of the dire situation that's developed in recent years. The question is, given the state of the Senate and the difficulty of the Democrats getting control there, and given who is in the White House and going to be there for the next 4 years or his party, how do you think this current trend can be halted or reversed? I mean, isn't every possibility that the Texas case, when it gets to the Supreme Court, is going to be approved 5-4, and there's going to be a majority in the Supreme Court for continuing what the 2013 decision was? And that's the first question. The second question is, how much of this do you think, since this all started pretty much 2010 or so, how much of this do you think is really a reaction to Barack Obama's election as president and effort by the Republican Party to deal with the fact that in an increasingly diverse America, the only way that their party can keep winning national office is by reducing the size of the electorate?
Thank you for a very pointed question. I can't, in response to one question, celebrate the necessity of the independence of our press and not welcome a very thoughtful and pointed question. And thank you for what the Dallas Morning News does, and thank you to the National Press Club for being a place that has really supported an independent press here in our nation's capital. So I referenced before the history of the civil rights movement and the role of faith. Jim Crow was incredibly, deeply embedded in states and communities across this country. It was brutal. It was unjust. It was immoral. And to hope that simply good preaching, followed by good marching, followed by what John Lewis would call getting into good trouble, mm-hmm. would change anything, was to hope in the face of a history that brutally demonstrated a long record of the opposite. Why did John Lewis think that when he began leading a march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, that getting his skull cracked open would lead to anything other than a lasting headache? Because he had faith in the power of love and of reconciliation in this country, and he believed that there were people in this country who had been doing things and saying things and voting for things that in their gut they knew was wrong, and that they could still be reached. That John Lewis believed that about our country, about a community in which he'd been raised, when he had been treated so brutally so many times, is still, I think, a transformative gift to us. How is it possible that a man named Nelson Mandela walked out of prison, having sacrificed his entire adult life to the brutality of an apartheid regime, and was yet able to lead a nation on a path towards reconciliation rather than retribution? John Lewis is one of those few people I've met in my life who really embodies what it means to be radically committed to loving one another, even in the face of evil. How do I have any hope whatsoever that the Supreme Court will actually make a different decision? How do I have any hope whatsoever that my Republican colleagues, who currently won't co-sponsor a bill that would restore the Voting Rights Act, may yet change their mind? Because I believe they have constituents who still have ears that will be opened, who still have hearts that could be enlightened, and who still might reach them. Without that hope, I couldn't get on a 7:15 train from Wilmington, Delaware every morning and come down here and try to legislate with people whose actions, frankly, suggest otherwise. We are in a very dire place and time. It is easy to be hopeless. And perhaps the fact that I am citing these sources suggests just how hopeless I at times have been. But if you look at our living recent history, when we march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge every year, it's not with a recording of John Lewis. Mm-hmm. It's with John Lewis, a congressman. And when he talks about the KKK thug who beat him in Rocky Mount, he also tells the story of how 30 years later that man and his son came to visit him in his congressional office to, with weeping, beg his forgiveness. It is possible to overcome unjust actions and injustice. But it is going to take continuing to stand, continuing to march, continuing to preach, and continuing to challenge the actions that are currently being taken in courts and legislatures around the country.
And I'm just going...
Would you like to remind me the second half of the
you
question?
You know what? And Senator, I'm going to ask you to try to answer that one briefly because there are many other hands that are up. And I'm going to have to remind everybody else, one question only, so we can get to as many as possible.
I'm supposed to leave.
Yes, I know, I know.
I choose to remain hopeful that the most racist, nativist, brutal, and unjust motivations are not the full explanation for the kinds of actions we're talking about. But the correlation in timing and geography is really striking. I'm from a state where our racial history is long and hard and ugly. And I grew up in a community and a context where people of goodwill had done bad things for a long time. So I do think that the election of Barack Obama played a central role in motivating people across this country to act in certain ways and vote in certain ways that are a that are motivated by some of the worst sides of human character, not the best sides.
Okay, yes. Could you stand up for us?
Sure.
Thank you.
My name's Hui Chen. I'm here as a just concerned citizen and a lawyer who works as a government contractor. I am concerned about the recent departure of the head of Census Bureau, and I am curious as to whether you have views on, you know, whether there are concerns in our census capabilities and whatever that departure may indicate and how that might impact voting rights.
Briefly, yes, I'm aware. Yes, I'm concerned. And who counts really has a big impact on which states get what access to what federal resources, and also has an impact on what are the numbers we're working from, whether it's in litigation or in planning for the next election or in where there need to be polling places, and I share your concern. The census is something we have managed to do ever since the founding of the country, and it is important that those numbers be as close to accurate as is possible. It is a key piece of having a foundation for a functioning democracy.
And Senator, I'm watching the clock for you. I think we have time maybe for one more. Okay.
I'll even do two.
Okay, great.
Which I
Thank
know is crazy,
you.
But
Thank
here we
you.
Go.
Hi. Hi, I'm Deborah Berrien with USA Today. There's an effort, as you know, led by Greg Harper of Mississippi to eliminate the EAC. Can you speak to where, look at that face. Could you speak to whether there's such an effort on the Senate side, the pushback there, and what impact, if any, it might have to eliminate the agency?
There may well be such an effort. There's an effort in the president's budget to eliminate dozens of agencies and functions. The running joke in my office is that it's almost as if someone in OMB had the list of the annual appropriations requests I make and just went through it and eliminated all those organizations. I know that it is not that specific.
So don't print that.
But it's striking how many organizations that I think are important or that contribute to the vibrancy of our society and our democracy are targeted either for elimination or significant funding reductions. Look, I'm not aware of a focused effort to eliminate the EAC in the Senate. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. There probably is a bill to eliminate it. Our challenge is to keep pushing and insisting on the resources, on the independence, on the effectiveness of this entity that was created to address demonstrable problems with our voting systems. Last question.
Hi, Senator. My name is Julie. I'm with Media Matters for America. Thank you for being here today. I want to touch on something you said earlier, which is pushing back against misinformation. And we've seen under President Trump during the campaign the flexibility of the truth, to put it nicely. And, you know, you've seen Trump make these outrageous claims about voter fraud, and those, as I've seen in my line of research, have been echoed by conservative media. How do you have a conversation with people about an issue and how to solve an issue if you can't even agree on the facts or if there is an issue to begin with when it comes to voter fraud on one side and voter suppression on another?
That is one of our core challenges, not just in the Senate or the Congress, but in our country. I assume if I asked for a show of hands how many of you went to a Thanksgiving dinner with your family, it'd be pretty much everybody here or a lot of people here. Thanksgiving dinner is an American tradition where not just your immediate blood relatives show up, but a whole bunch of people. And it tends to be the one time, as I heard from folks in my office, when you've got to deal with that relative who really doesn't share your political views, and then a whole lot of other people in between. And what I think has made our Thanksgiving dinner table conversation as a country steadily harder and harder over the last generation is the disagreement about the description of reality. This is reinforced, in some cases fed, by the disaggregation of media outlets so that you can watch either on your phone or on the internet or on television something that really only reinforces your assumptions about the world and cites facts, factoids, or alternative facts, which aren't facts, they're actually lies, that reinforce what you want to hear. Then having a discussion about what the United States ought to do in the world, or about what the problems are facing our country,
about what it is Congress is doing or is not doing are really hard to do when the first hour has to be spent simply arguing through what are the facts. That's why an independent press that actually asks hard questions, holds us accountable, and reports on facts is critical. That's why civics education in school, so that folks better understand the functions of our government and the pieces of it that work and don't, is more challenging. There is no substitute for trust and a relationship in order to have a conversation where you begin with a disagreement over facts. And the problem with relationship and trust is it takes time, sacrifice, and a commitment to common values. At the end of the day, we are only going to make progress on issues in Congress where we remind ourselves that we do have a commitment to common values and where we can then make sacrifices or changes in order to accomplish those common values. I remain convinced that a commitment to democracy is actually held by a majority of Americans. What that means and what they're willing to give up and what they're willing to risk in order to have a democracy is a conversation we're in the middle of. And I'm going to work tirelessly to make sure that it comes out as a democracy where every American has a voice, where neither money, nor race, nor gender, nor other pernicious things close out the voices of any American. I hope you'll be part of that journey with me. Thank you.
Good to be with you so much. It was wonderful, Senator. Senator.
We're looking at him.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today. Again, a sincere thanks to Senator Coons for his timely and wonderful remarks. And I'd like to again thank the Press Club and thank all of my colleagues at the Brennan Center who made today possible. Again, we will be holding additional conversations and events like this, and we ask you to join us. And please continue to follow us and all of the news and work that we are doing at the Brennan Center to help protect our democracy on brennancenter.org. Thank you, and have a wonderful afternoon.